In our new series, World War II's Greatest Battles, we chart five pivotal moments that shaped the course of the conflict with military historian James Holland. New episodes drop every Thursday on the History Extra podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to the History Extra podcast, fascinating historical conversations from the makers of BBC History Magazine. At the turn of the 20th century, millions of European Jews were seeking an escape from anti-Semitic persecution. While many dreamed of Palestine, a few thousand made their way instead to Galveston in Texas. In her new book, Melting Point, the author Rachel Cockrell tells the story of this little-known Galveston movement and reveals how it connects to the histories of America, Zionism, and European Jewry. She spoke to Rob Attar.
First of all, Rachel, how did you first come across this story of the Galveston community?
I came across the story in a very roundabout way. I was interested in my family, but not my great-grandfather who was involved in the Galveston movement, but the next generation down, his daughter, who was my grandmother, and her sister, who raised their children together with both of their husbands in a fairly shambolic, gigantic house in North London in the years after World War II. It was a house with around 13 or 14 people in it, seven children, four adults, and then various other people as well. Me and my siblings had kind of heard stories about this house growing up because it's how my dad was raised. I was just always very curious to find out more. And I thought maybe it would make a good book, but I thought perhaps I better start the book by explaining how my family came to England. All I knew was that my grandmother had come here as a child from Russia, speaking no English, but I didn't really know anything more than that. I then Googled my great-grandfather, her father. I found sort of a surprising number of results on Google, and his name was always mentioned in connection with the word Galveston. I don't think I'd ever heard the word before. I think, like most English people, I don't know much about Texan geography. So it took me a while before I realized that Galveston was a place in Texas, and even longer to realize that my great-grandfather was part of this forgotten slice of American history, the Galveston movement, where he sent 10,000 Russian Jews to Texas. This was in the lead up to World War I, when they were all trying to leave Russia and go to New York. So yeah, I started the more and more I found out about it, the more obsessed I got. And it was partly because everyone involved seemed to be sort of really compelling characters, and the whole story just entranced me.
And it's an unexpected story, isn't it? Because I don't think you'd naturally associate groups of Russian Jews with Texas, would you? It will probably come as a surprise to quite a few people reading the book, I guess.
Yeah, it will. I mean, it's funny because I went to Texas and it's sort of not a surprise to any of them. They think, you know, of course we have lots of synagogues here. And of course there's Russian Texan food. And I even heard one descendant of one of the immigrants who went to Galveston sent me a recording of his grandmother who had come from Russia to Texas as a teenager. And she had a Russian Texan accent, which was really unlike anything I'd ever heard before. Very, very strange. You know, these immigrants would arrive in Texas and send postcards back to Russia. They had sort of gone to special photo studios and got portraits taken of them in cowboy outfits, you know, cowboy hats and cowboy boots. But on the back was this writing, either in Russian or in Yiddish, saying, oh, it's so wonderful in this strange new place. So yeah, it's sort of incongruous. You don't really associate Russia and Jews and Texas together. But for the descendants of the Galveston movement, it seems totally natural.
And I suppose it would be useful to actually explain why this is happening. And what can you tell us about the situation of Jews in Russia at the turn of the 20th century?
The situation was not good. Not only were they confined to a particular part of Russia, which was called the Pale of the Settlement, it was in the western part of the Russian Empire. And I mean, when I say Russian Empire, that sort of encapsulates other places we don't consider to be Russia now, like Poland and Ukraine. So yeah, they were confined to this area called the Pale of the Settlement, but also the Russians had some hatred towards them, either jealousy or just racism. So these pogroms started breaking out in the late 19th and early 20th century, where Russian Christians would sort of go through the streets, destroying Jewish homes and businesses and killing Jews as well. So for example, one Russian Jew wrote, "May God grant that I may soon be able to turn my back upon this bloody country." So they all wanted to leave, and they had their sights set on America.
But then interestingly, there's another dynamic going on at the same time, isn't there? Because alongside these Jews wanting to go to America and then later the Galveston movement, you've also got the early Zionist movement, which is where Jews are hoping initially to go to Palestine. So how do these different groups interact?
The Zionist movement, the sort of modern Zionist movement, started just before the huge mass of immigration to America. So mass immigration from Russia to America started in sort of the early 1900s, and Zionism was founded in 1897 by Theodore Herzl, who saw that the Jewish situation in Russia was bad and also saw that the Jews had this ancient claim to Palestine. He was slightly naive and he thought, oh, what could possibly go wrong? I will be the person to found modern Zionism and create a Jewish homeland in Palestine. He worked on it year after year in the early 1900s and was making no progress. Meanwhile, the pogroms in Russia were getting more and more intense and violent. And America was sort of the solution, or at least the temporary solution. They didn't really have immigration quotas. And as soon as a few Russian Jews started going there, they would then write back to their brothers or their cousins or their friends in Russia and say, you must come here. So by sort of 1905, 1910, every Jew in Russia had a sort of brother or a cousin or a friend in America who was saying, you must come here, bring your family.
But these Jews at this point were mainly going to places like New York, weren't they, on the Eastern Seaboard?
Yes. New York in probably 1905 was the greatest Jewish centre the world had ever known. The Lower East Side had, I think, well, I'm terrible with numbers, even after sort of writing this book for 5 years. I think around 1 million Jews in New York, and mainly on the Lower East Side of New York. It was the kind of place where New Yorkers didn't really walk through because it was just so strange. It was like stepping into another world. There were sort of Yiddish theatres and synagogues and restaurants with Hebrew or Yiddish signs outside. It was just totally alien to them, really. And again, no immigration quotas. So more and more Jews were arriving at Ellis Island, where, you know, the immigration port of New York, and sort of not venturing very far inland to this vast continent, but just settling in the Lower East Side where they knew people and where it sort of felt like Russia, which had been transplanted across the Atlantic.
Was there much opposition within the United States to this large influx of Jewish refugees, immigrants coming in?
The Americans did not have a huge amount of opposition to it. It was sort of thought of as a very young country, a young continent, and that the whole idea of the Statue of Liberty is that you take the sort of dregs of Europe, the waifs and strays of the old world, and America will accept them. But the German Jews in New York, the sort of more established Jews, the Jews who had been there maybe for a few decades or longer, looked upon this huge influx of Russian Jews who had sometimes ragged clothing and didn't speak a word of English, and saw a future in which anti-Semitism would become a real problem in New York. One character in my book, Jacob Schiff, who was a German Jewish banker, extremely wealthy, and liked to sort of dabble in philanthropy as well. He said, "These immigrants may become a menace to this country. This we must not risk."
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
The holidays have arrived early with Blinds.com's Spring Black Friday sale. Upgrading window coverings can be a minor project with a major impact. Blinds.com makes it easy and affordable. Browse premium blinds, shades, shutters. We have your patio covered too. And get unlimited window treatments installed for one low cost. Free shipping and Blinds.com's 100% satisfaction guarantee. Shop Blinds.com's Spring Black Friday sale now. Save up to 45% plus premium doorbusters. Up to 45% off at Blinds.com. Rules and restrictions may apply.
As we've discussed earlier, your book focuses on this Galveston movement, but it also looks at some other proto-Jewish homelands or ideas of Jewish homelands elsewhere in the world. And I was particularly interested in one that was going to be set up in East Africa. I wonder if you could tell us about that.
Yes. So people talk about England's involvement with Israel and with Zionism, and this is sort of where it all started. Theodor Herzl, the founder of Zionism, was struggling to buy Palestine, or at least buy a sort of charter for the Jews to colonize Palestine. Meanwhile, the first huge pogrom of the 20th century had broken out in 1903, the Kishinev pogrom. At this time, he approached the British government and said, "I'm looking for somewhere temporary, a sort of temporary Jewish homeland. Perhaps you could, while Palestine's doors remain closed, perhaps you could help me." And the colonial secretary, a job which no longer exists in the British government at the time, Joseph Chamberlain, was by all accounts quite charmed by Herzl because he was quite charming, and decided to help him. He had taken a train through East Africa, I think sort of 6 months before, and he wrote down that this land that he looked out of the train window at was so beautiful and reminded him of England. So when he met Herzl, he said to him, "I think I have found a land for you, and that's Uganda." And then, yes, the British government formally offered the Jews Uganda amid much controversy.
Yes, that's right, because this caused quite a split in the Zionist movement, didn't it, between, I guess you might call them, purists, for whom it was Palestine or nothing, and then other people, perhaps more pragmatically, who said, well, let's accept somewhere else in the short term. How was that kind of split resolved?
It sort of wasn't resolved, really. It was really disastrous in more ways than one, which I won't sort of spoil. But Uganda was offered, and some people thought, you know, this is a temporary solution. We're not taking our eyes off the end goal of Palestine, but the Jews have to be saved, and they have to be saved now. Israel Zangwill, who's a character in my book I'm sure we'll talk more about, said sometimes, he sort of had a funny way with words. It was something like, sometimes the long route proves the shortest and the shortcut is actually the longest. He thought that Uganda was almost sort of the quick way to get to Palestine. Meanwhile, others thought it was a betrayal of Zionism. When Theodor Herzl presented this offer to the Jews, there was a sort of ripple of confusion. And then people in the audience started shouting traitor at him because they thought he was betraying everything that they had longed for and hoped for.
And do we have much of a sense of what the response was from people within East Africa, I suppose both the colonial authorities and the people, other people living there?
I don't particularly have a sense of what the response was of the native people. It was called the Uganda Plan, but it was actually in Kenya, which sort of shows just how vague the British people thought of these far-flung places. Seemed so vague and distant that they almost couldn't discern between individual countries within a continent. So I don't know what the Kenyans thought of it, but the British colonialists living in this part of East Africa were slightly horrified. One of them wrote a letter to the Times saying, this country is for English settlers, not for Jewish settlers. We've paid this country dearly through the blood and money of English subjects. And yet it was sort of, they hated the idea of their wonderful colony being taken over by Jews.
So how then did Galveston come into the picture as another alternative potential Jewish homeland?
It sort of was, again, a sort of bit of an accident. Israel Zangwill, who left the Zionist movement after the Uganda plan was rejected, because he was the one who thought this is the shortcut, he then decided to look all over the world for somewhere else, another temporary homeland. He founded this organization, the Jewish Territorial Organization, looking for another Jewish territory. And he approached governments in Australia and Canada and Paraguay and Mexico and many other places saying, could we buy some of your land? You have huge countries. Maybe we could just take a small piece of your land and settle there while we wait for Palestine. And the American Jews, again, Jacob Schiff, who I mentioned earlier, the German Jewish banker, sort of caught wind of Israel Zangwill's ambitions. And also the fact that Israel Zangwill was failing in his ambitions. All these countries were saying no to him. You know, the Australian government, for example, said that is totally out of the question. So Jacob Schiff said to Zangwill, if you'd be willing to temporarily abandon your ambition, then maybe we could work together. He was the one who wanted the number of Jews in New York to stop increasing so exponentially. But he also saw that America was this huge continent and that actually maybe if the Jews entered through another port, probably along the east coast of America, then they could spread out into the country rather than sort of congregating just on the very edge of the country.
So his idea then is less a kind of Jewish homeland, as say Israel is now, and more just diverse immigration into a much larger country and a safer country.
Yes, he was very patriotic about America. He wanted a solution for the horrible Jewish problem in Russia. He saw that his co-religionists, as the term they used then, were being persecuted and killed in Russia. So he thought two birds with one stone. He wanted all the immigrants from Russia to come to America, but just not to congregate in New York and create a sort of, you know, as he said, a menace to the rest of the country.
And you've mentioned Zangwill's name a couple of times already. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit more about him, because he was a man who, maybe not so well known now, but at the time was quite a sort of big intellectual and cultural figure.
Yes, I feel like I got to know him quite well over the last few years of writing this book. And I think he would be horrified at how thoroughly he's been forgotten. Because at the time, you know, in probably, I think his fame peaked probably in around 1900 or 1910. He was hugely famous. He was such a huge celebrity that if he walked through the streets of London, for example, if he walked around Piccadilly, people would swarm towards him and, you know, want to take his hand and say, you don't know me, but I know you. Your books are so wonderful. And the same thing happened when he was in America. He went on these huge lecture tours across America. Even if he went to a small town in America and gave a lecture, the lecture hall would be full. So yes, he was this huge celebrity thought of as the Jewish Dickens, because he wrote these novels about the Jewish ghetto in London. Again, a term that people probably don't think of much, but East London had a huge number of Jews, similar to the Lower East Side in New York. And people thought his novels had sort of opened their eyes to this world that they would have otherwise had no access to, as if it were a million miles away and a million years ago. He was also just apparently very funny, very charming, had an incredibly impressive way with words, was always inventing new phrases and things. These phrases that he invented were called Zangwillisms because it just became a household word because he was so well known, but also extremely shambolic, always sort of quite poorly dressed, no matter how much effort he made, slightly too long hair, always things falling out of his pockets. Yeah, a sort of awkward figure, but had such a great intellect and such great wit that he was sort of magnetic.
And he was also the man who coined the phrase melting pot, which was one of his plays, I believe.
Yeah, it's quite funny because my book is called Melting Point and Zangwill's play is called Melting Pot. But almost always when I say to people the title of my book, Melting Point, they'll either repeat back to me or sort of 5 seconds later, they'll say, oh, Melting Pot. And it's funny because, you know, in almost every way, Zangwill has been forgotten. But this phrase, melting pot, is almost his legacy, really. People who think they don't know who Zangwill is have this term that he coined in their brains and they use it. This was a play that he wrote kind of in response to the Galveston movement. The point of the play was sort of, the melting pot of America is a wonderful thing. All the inhabitants of Europe who want to leave Europe can come to America and be absorbed into the great American melting pot. This play that he wrote, it premiered in Washington, and the opening night sounds just incredible. The President Roosevelt was there. All the most famous people in Washington at the time were all there, and it got a huge standing ovation. It was, yeah, I kind of wish I'd been there. And it sort of got the nation talking, you know, like things do nowadays. People talk about things on Twitter. It was sort of the equivalent at the time. People saying, is this the great American play? And also, is America the melting pot? And is that a good thing? It created a lot of discourse.
And so coming back to Galveston, what kind of a place greeted the arrivals there?
Galveston, yeah, this place that I had never really heard of. And I sort of, a lot of people I tell, they sort of, their eyes glaze over a bit because they've never really heard of it either. There's a song about it, which I think some people do know, but that's about the extent of people's knowledge of Galveston. It was once, in around 1900, 1899, it was one of the most prosperous cities in America. I think it was one of the top five richest cities in America. This is partly because of its location. It's on the Gulf of Mexico, and it meant that cotton could come in and come out. It was just this incredible port, and it was also very beautiful. It had very beautifully built houses. It had oleanders lining the streets and palm trees and banana trees and a perfect climate. So, you know, you were in this amazing city, but also you could hear the sound of the waves crashing on the shore. So it was, yeah, it was thought of as sort of the perfect, one of America's finest cities. That all changed in 1900 when a hurricane destroyed Galveston. It's still known as the biggest natural disaster in US history. And it's sort of, the waters of the Gulf were sort of taken up by this hurricane and thrown onto the city, submerging it, but also destroying all the buildings, or many of the buildings. There are photos taken in the aftermath, which just show sort of bits of wood and bits of debris stretching to the horizon in some parts of the city. And Galveston, it sort of never really recovered. It did rebuild, and, you know, there was high morale in the years afterwards of, you know, we're going to recover and it's all going to be fine. But it never became what it once was. The reason this was made it a perfect city for the Jewish immigrants to arrive in was that it didn't offer a huge number of temptations. It wasn't like coming to New York, where you got there and suddenly all your friends were around you. There were opportunities everywhere you looked. It was thought that a Jewish person arriving in Galveston would be quite happy to get on a train somewhere else once they'd arrived, because they weren't sort of entranced by this place. So, yes, that's why it was chosen, really.
The Jews who made the journey to Galveston, did they decide on this destination? Were they given different options, or how did that whole process work?
The sort of common response when these Jews in Russia were asked, will you go to Texas, was, but I want to go to America. And what they meant by that was, but I want to go to New York. But they thought America and New York were sort of synonyms. They didn't really know anything other than that New York was this small town at the edge of the New World where so many of their friends and relatives were. So there weren't really other options. And my great-grandfather's job, I think, was to go around Russia and ask these Jews who wanted to go to New York if they would consider going to Texas instead. And there were even these, you know, pamphlets that the organization produced saying, oh, you know, Texas is so wonderful. It's so sunny. There are so many opportunities, whether you stay in Texas or whether you go elsewhere in the sort of American West. It's just so wonderful and so much better than New York.
What was the kind of response of the people already living in Galveston to firstly the plan and then the arrival of all these Russian Jewish immigrants?
The Galvestonians, as they're called, were quite happy about it, partly because it wasn't that these Jews were going to colonize Galveston, that in fact, I think almost no Jews from this movement were allowed to actually stay in Galveston, you know, 1% of them or something. And they were either sent to somewhere else in Texas, you know, Austin, Dallas, Houston, or further afield. So the people in Galveston didn't really have a problem with it. And also, I think they didn't really understand. They'd never been to Russia. They didn't know any, you know, many Jewish people. These people were just somewhere from an unfathomable place coming here. And, you know, maybe they had been in some trouble in the place they'd come from. And they were just going to sort of take these opportunities that America presented, you know, at the turn of the century. And yeah, it was sort of all fine for them. I mean, what I really enjoyed about researching this book was seeing the sort of lack of xenophobia at the beginning of the 20th century in America. It was partly because there hadn't been a sort of huge amount of immigration from Europe, you know, mass immigration up till that point. And the thought was, we've got to get people to do these jobs that this continent needs. So they were quite happy to have them, really.
What kind of impression did the Russian Jews have of Texas once they arrived there?
One account that I found, this man called Gerwitz, who came in, I think, around 1912, he was in his 50s. And he was sort of middle class, lived in Russia, and he and his wife got on a boat. And at first, he was quite disillusioned by Texas. I think he went to San Antonio, and it looked to him a bit like Russia, sort of unpaved streets, you know, animals in the streets, but also, you know, mosquitoes everywhere and very unhygienic. And he thought, why did I leave Russia for this? You know, he said, I was angry at Columbus in that moment. But then, you know, he settled there and lived there for the rest of his life. And it took him a few years, but he soon became very happy with it. And I think he became an American, really. He became patriotic and proud of the country, and his children became American. Yeah, it all sort of ended happily ever after for him.
So that's an interesting point then. How far did the Russian Jews assimilate into American society, or how far did they try to remain distinctive?
Well, the book is called Melting Point because it's about assimilation, really, mainly in America, but also I think it's a universal thing which we don't talk about enough, which is that if you're an immigrant, you inevitably lose something from the place you came from. And if you don't lose it, then your children lose it. And if they don't lose it, then their children lose it. Eventually, maybe it's inevitable that you melt into the melting pot, whoever you are and wherever you live. So the Russian Jews who went to Galveston did assimilate. I went there and I met their descendants. And one of them showed me a sort of candelabra that is used during Jewish holidays that her mother had passed down to her and her mother had passed down to her. And she actually started crying at one point because she said that she was scared that her children and her children's children wouldn't use it. The Russian Jewish culture is so rich in storytelling and tradition. And I do think that that got lost when they went to America, or at least if it didn't get lost, then it got lost in the next generation or the one after. So I still sort of don't know how to feel about the Galveston movement. Obviously, these Jews were saved from their fate in Europe, whether they got killed in the pogroms or in World War One or World War Two. There are very few Jews left in Russia now. But coming to America, maybe they lost their Russianness or their Jewishness and sort of just became shiny new Americans. And that's quite sad in a way.
And was that more the case in Texas because the Jews were more dispersed than they were in somewhere like New York?
Yeah, I think it definitely, the Jews in New York were not really in the melting pot because, or at least, you know, the Jews in the Lower East Side of New York, because the melting pot they were in was all fellow Russian Jews or German Jews. Some of them didn't even learn English for a long time because they could just get by speaking Yiddish in New York. In fact, Zangwill said, the Jews on the Lower East Side of New York speak Yiddish with a twang. Yeah, they really were able to cling on to their Jewishness for longer, whereas a lot of the Jews who went to America through Galveston sometimes went to a town or a city where there were very few Jews, and they sort of, yeah, they lost it a lot quicker, I think.
And when did the Galveston movement, as in like this kind of the emigration of Jews from Europe to Galveston, when did that come to an end?
It came to an end just before World War I broke out. There had been several problems with the movement, including the fact that the journey was quite grueling. It was days and days longer than the journey to New York, I think maybe a week or so longer, and in not particularly pleasant conditions. There had been a few problems with the US immigration authorities being too strict. And then also, I think it was seen that World War I was about to break out and the, you know, transatlantic traffic would be more difficult. But I think, I don't know how big a part World War I played in the Galveston movement coming to an end, but all these problems sort of conspired against them, really.
And I wonder if you could tell us a bit more about your own family's connection to the Galveston movement. You've touched on it throughout this conversation, but perhaps you give us a few more details.
My great-grandfather was an early Zionist. He was at the first Zionist congresses at the very beginning of the 20th century. And he was pro-Uganda, so he thought Uganda was a good temporary solution. And when Uganda was rejected, he and Zangwill and others stormed out of the Congress and decided to form their own sort of, not really a splinter movement, but almost a rival to Zionism. And, you know, all the headlines at the time said, Zionism splits. And again, that's sort of been forgotten now, but it was this huge rift. So, yeah, my great-grandfather joined the Jewish Territorial Organization, which Zangwill was sort of the head of. He was born in Lithuania, but he eventually lived in Kyiv. And his job was to sort of go around Russia, finding Jews who wanted to go to New York and persuading them to go to Texas instead. And he did actually, he went to Texas himself and to sort of see how the movement was getting along and to meet some of the immigrants. And then eventually Zangwill, who he became close friends with, persuaded him to move to London when the Galveston movement started winding down. So yeah, I have Zangwill to thank for my existence, really.
Do you know how he reflected on the Galveston movement later on? Did he view it as having been a success?
I don't know. It's quite sad because he didn't really write anything about himself. You know, a lot of the material that I worked with while writing my book were these memoirs and, you know, autobiographies and articles that Jewish journalists and Jewish novelists wrote in the beginning of the 20th century. Maybe Jews are especially reflective, I don't know, but I had this huge wealth of first-hand material. My great-grandfather was, one person wrote, he was a mysteriously unpublicized figure. And my elevator pitch is that this book is about him, but he's this sort of silent figure in the book. The book revolves around him and his family, but he is not really the main character in the book. So I don't actually know how he reflected later on the Galveston movement. He also died quite young. He died in his 70s, and maybe he'd planned to write about it at some point, but never really got around to it.
This book does potentially speak to some of the events taking place in the world right now. Obviously, it's quite a topical subject. And there have been, over the years, critics of Zionism who have said, well, you know, why did the Jews choose to move to Palestine, surrounded by enemies? Why didn't they, say, create an Israel in America, somewhere else, Australia? You know, does this book speak to any of those arguments or debates at all, do you think?
It's funny because I have heard conversations in recent months saying, you know, surely we could find somewhere else. And it's strange for me because obviously this movement of trying, you know, the Jewish Territorial Organization's attempt to find somewhere else failed, really. And yeah, it seems like maybe it could have been possible or maybe it could still be possible, but they tried it and they didn't succeed.
And another thing I wanted to talk to you about is the format of the book, which, for anyone who hasn't read it yet, it's quite an unusual one. So I wonder if you could talk to us about the approach you've taken and why you've decided to write the book in this way.
Sure. When I started writing the book, I tried to write it in a normal way. I was a huge fan of Jewish family memoirs like The Hair with Amber Eyes and East West Street and others. And I thought, oh, maybe you know, maybe this story could be written in this way. So I wrote a first draft, and as I read it back, I sort of found myself feeling annoyed at my own interjections. So it was, you know, the classic way you write a nonfiction memoir is you have your own narrative voice interwoven with quotations from others. And every time it was my voice, I just thought, oh, shut up. I think partly because, you know, some of these other memoirs, the narrator, i.e. the author, is a sort of character in the book. So, you know, it's Edmund Duval sort of going in search of his family, and his personality really shines through. Whereas I wasn't a character in early Zionism or in the Galveston movement. So it was just sort of me saying things like, Zangwill was clearly conflicted, and it was such a sort of waste of space, because then the next sentence would be a quote from Zangwill in which he was clearly conflicted. So sort of as an experiment, I started deleting my own narrative. I'd also read a book called Lincoln in the Bardo, which is quite a sort of controversial book. People either love it or hate it. It's a novel, but it's all in quotes, some made up quotes, some real quotes. So it talks about the American Civil War, and it'll be some real accounts and some made up accounts. So I sort of knew that something similar could be done. And also, I think, you know, in documentaries, it's much more common. You know, you either have a voiceover and then all the interviewees talking, or you don't have a voiceover and it still works. Whereas that doesn't really happen in nonfiction. But I thought, I wonder if I can do it. So I started weaving these quotes together, and it was quite nice because they sort of, some of them contradicted each other. They seemed to sort of interact with each other, despite the fact they were written by usually people who are long dead. And it felt a bit like a tightrope walk. I wondered if I could sustain it for the whole book, or whether there were some bits which I needed to sort of fill in. But, you know, even the parts which I thought I needed to fill in, for example, I had heard that Israel Zangwill had persuaded my great-grandfather to move to England. I didn't have any quotes about it. I didn't see it written down anywhere. But eventually I did find a letter from Zangwill saying, "Your future belongs to England." So all these sort of parts which I thought, oh, I won't be able to do it there, suddenly I found something which meant I could do it there. And it was extremely satisfying sort of plugging in all the gaps and getting this whole thing to flow and to work.
Foregrounding these primary sources, I guess you'd call them, in this way, I think it's really interesting because you get a real sense of the kind of the language, but also the attitudes of the time. I mean, in a way, it's quite shocking sometimes seeing the way that, say, Jews were described, kind of casually described at the turn of the century, and also some of the descriptions of the African people when you're talking about that kind of African scheme. I mean, were you surprised at all at some of the kind of casual prejudices and racism that commonplace at this time?
Yeah, and I should say that was also part of the joy of it, was sort of presenting these sources without comment, but you I hope you can sort of maybe feel what I think about them, because some of these things are so sort of shocking. I think not having a narrator just takes you straight there. I hope it sometimes feels a bit like time traveling, because you're sort of right there with it, right there with these characters and with the scenes they're describing, rather than having a 21st century voice saying Zangwill was clearly conflicted. But yeah, the racism and the xenophobia at the time, it did shock me. And it shocked, you know, as I was researching the book, I was reading these things out to people, these things out that I found, and they were shocked as well. I think it's funny because I don't think it's quite like modern racism. I think there was something naive about it, you know, describing people who lived in East Africa as savages, things like that. It was just the way you described them. It wasn't, maybe there wasn't a huge amount of sort of hatred behind it, but it was just so commonplace. And again, describing Jews in certain offensive ways, that it was sort of like they know not what they do. But yeah, it was very different, because obviously in the book, the writing style is quite modern in many ways. You almost feel that some of the characters could have lived here and now with us. But then some of their attitudes were just reminded you that this was more than 100 years ago.
That was Rachel Cockrell. Her book, Melting Point, is out now, published by Wildfire. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Jack Bateman.